This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through the book of 2 Corinthians. Now, here's Pastor Sandy in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 as he begins his message, Fit for Heaven.
Arthur J. Strack writes about an NBA basketball game that he once attended. This game ended rather strangely. Dallas Mavericks point guard Derek Harper dribbled the final 6 seconds off the clock. The score was tied, and they could have used the seconds to win the game. Harper thought that his team was up by a point, and so he dribbled away those 6 seconds. The Mavericks could have used the time that he wasted to win the game. In fact, they ended up losing in overtime. Strack wrote afterwards, "Dribble, dribble, dribble, go the seconds, the minutes, the hours, the days, the years of our lives." How often have you dribbled away valuable seconds you could have used to win the game? You could have won a prize, the prize for knowing Christ. You could have won a reward for serving God. You could have won a lost soul to Jesus Christ. Instead, we dribbled away the seconds. It was like we had time to waste instead of a game to win. Well, Paul's goal in chapters 4 and 5 is to help us to avoid that mistake. In 2 Corinthians chapter 5, his sights are set on eternity. Paul is focused on the judgment seat of Christ, and he encourages us not to waste a single second. Chapter 5 begins, "For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." Now, in ancient times, a Jewish rabbi not only studied the scriptures, but he also learned a trade. Paul worked with canvas. He made sails and tents. Acts chapter 18 tells us that when he first arrived in Corinth, he found a Jewish couple there named Aquila and Priscilla, and he stayed with them for the 18 months that he was in town. Verse 3 of Acts chapter 18 explains their connection. "Because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for by occupation they were tent makers." Rather than burden the believers in Corinth, Paul worked a job and paid his own way. Paul was the preacher who also made tents. In the early days of our church, we had very little financial backing, so I worked a warehouse job to support my family. To this day, when a pastor works a second job to make ends meet, we say it's his tent-making job. My point is that Paul knew about tents. And he opens chapter 5 by comparing our bodies with a tent. He paints a contrast. Our earthly bodies are like a portable tent, whereas our heavenly bodies are like a building. A cloth tent is fragile and flimsy and subject to the elements. A brick building, in contrast, is strong and stable. It offers max protection. A tent is meant to be a temporary dwelling, whereas a building is a permanent structure. It's amazing that here in verse 1, the apostle describes the most dreadful moment in a person's life. I mean the event that we're all hoping to prolong as long as possible, our death. He talks about it as simply striking a tent, just pulling up a few pegs, collapsing a couple of poles, folding up the canvas. You know, in our culture, death gets depicted as the Grim Reaper, a sinister character who kills and steals. For most people, death is frightful, but not for Paul. To him, the hassle was life in this human body. Death was a relief. It was like striking a tent and moving back into the house. Reminds me of the night Sherlock Holmes and his trusty assistant, Mr. Watson, Dr. Watson, they went camping. Well, around midnight, Holmes nudges Watson awake, and he tells him, he said, "Watson, look up into the night sky and tell me what you see." Watson says, "Well, I see the glory of God." The heavens truly declare His handiwork. I'm also reminded of God's sovereignty. He orders the orbits of all the heavenly bodies, and He rules the universe. Certainly, the night sky tells us of our own smallness, that we live on a tiny little planet amongst millions of stars. And finally, well, I guess a cloudless night informs us of a beautiful day tomorrow. That's when Watson turns and he asks Holmes, he says, "And what do you see, Sherlock?" Sherlock Holmes responds, "Someone stole our tent." One day, your tent and my tent are going to be gone. Paul uses the word destroyed. It means to take down or to disassemble. Literally, we'll be folded up like a tent. The bodies that we're currently inhabiting are temporary dwellings. Even though most people want them to be, they were never meant to be permanent. They serve us only for a short time. They are collapsible tents. And some of our tents are collapsing more than others. I know a lot of you like to go camping, but not me. Sorry. My problem isn't sleeping under the stars or enjoying the outdoors. I just hate all the effort that goes into camping. I mean, what's the big deal? You pack up, you set up, you build the fire, you go through a can of bug spray, and then you go back and tear it all down, all for just a few hours outside. To me, going to all that effort to set up a tent in a campsite is a hassle. And so are these tent-like bodies. Think of the time and energy and money we waste maintaining our bodies. For starters, I have to refuel mine 3 times a day. Sometimes in between. Even my car runs a week on a tank of gas. I also have to park my body for a few hours each night. A body requires frequent oil changes. It needs a daily wash and wax. And to top it all off, I'm constantly driving it into the mechanic for repairs. To be quite honest, after 58 years, it's time for a new model. The upkeep on this old one is costing me too much. The odometer has flipped over. It's breaking down. It's harder to crank in the mornings. And yet I still need it to get around. Paul says that one day we'll swap these temporary and troublesome tents for more permanent structures. Christians have been promised a building from God. Paul spoke of this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Here's a few excerpts from that chapter. He writes, "There is a natural body and there is a spiritual body. However, the spiritual is not first, but the natural, and afterward the spiritual. I say, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, nor does corruption inherit incorruption. Behold, I tell you a mystery. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. The dead will be raised incorruptible, and we shall be changed. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality." At the rapture, when Jesus airlifts His church, our mortal bodies will be transformed into eternal, glorified bodies. Believers at the time and the bodies of Christians who have died in the faith will undergo an instant metamorphosis. We'll have a body like Jesus after His resurrection. Our heavenly bodies will be made from elements no longer subject to decay or to deterioration. Imagine your heavenly body won't have to be refueled, arrested, or repaired. A glorified body won't have to be set up or torn down. It's permanent. In your perfected body, you'll be able to take all your time, all your energy, and spend it on worshiping Jesus. One day, the spirit of every believer will be given the keys to hassle-free housing. We'll get glorified bodies. Once a family, they had a little ritual that they conducted whenever one of the children's pet goldfish died. Mom, dad, brother, and sister, they'd all gather in the bathroom around the commode. 2-year-old Drew would hold the fish, and 5-year-old Alexis, she would say a prayer, and then both children would drop the fish in the toilet and flush him to fish heaven. One such solemn occasion, after the goldfish had been sent to heaven, the little girl, she asked her mom if Grandpa, who had died a few years earlier, was also in heaven. The mom said confidently, "Yes, honey, he is." That's when the little boy asked, "Who flushed him?" Well, when the Lord returns for his church, we'll all flush these pup tent style bodies and we'll receive immortal, incorruptible bodies that will last for all eternity. In the meantime, we're stuck living in a very tentative tent. I ran across this past week a letter written and addressed to Mr. Tentmaker. I'll read it to you. "It was nice in this tent when it was strong and secure and the sun was shining and the air was warm. But Mr. Tentmaker, it's scary now. My tent is acting like it's not going to hold together. The poles seem weak and they shift with the wind. A couple of the stakes have wiggled loose, and worst of all, the canvas has a rip. It no longer protects me from the beating rain and stinging flies. It's scary in here, Mr. Tentmaker. Last week I was sent to the repair shop, and a repairman tried to patch the rip. It didn't help much, though, because the patch pulled away from the edges. Now the tear is worse. What troubled me most, Mr. Tentmaker, is that the repairman didn't seem to notice that I was still in the tent. They just worked on the canvas while I shivered inside. I cried out once, but no one heard me. I guess my real question is, why did you give me such a flimsy tent? I can see by looking around the campground that some of the tents are much stronger and more stable than mine. Why, Mr. Tentmaker, did you pick a tent of such poor quality for me? And even more importantly, what do you intend to do about it?" Well, Mr. Tentmaker must have gotten the letter because he issued a reply. Here's his response. "O little tent dweller, as the creator and provider of tents, I know all about you and your tent, and I love you both. I made a tent for myself once and lived in it on your campground. My tent was vulnerable too, and some vicious attackers ripped it to pieces while I was still in it. It was a terrible experience, but you'll be glad to know they couldn't hurt me. In fact, the whole occurrence was as a tremendous advantage because it is this victory over my enemy that frees me to be a present help to you. Little tent dweller, I am now prepared to come and live in your tent with you if you will invite me. You will learn as we dwell together that real security comes from me being in your tent with you. In the storms, you can huddle in my arms and I'll hold you. When the canvas rips, we'll go to the repair shop together. Someday, little tent dweller, your tent will collapse, for I've only designed it for temporary use. When it does, we'll leave together. I promise not to leave before you do. Then, free of all that would hinder or restrict, we'll move to our permanent home and together forever rejoice and be glad." That's our hope, isn't it? We have a building from God, a habitation in the heavens. Verse 3 continues, "For in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven." You know, someone humorously said, the real purpose of camping is to increase your appreciation of home. Well, that's definitely God's purpose for these flimsy tents. After being bogged down in these bodies, we should be groaning and yearning and longing for our heavenly home. Once there were a few friends, they were hanging out together. Someone posed the question to the others. He said, "What would you like for people to say about you at your funeral?" One of the friends commented, "Well, I hope they say I was a sincere Christian, that I cared about other people." Another fellow confessed. He said, "Well, I hope they say that I made a difference, that the world's a better place because I was here." The third fellow spoke up. He says, "Well, I hope they talk about my love for my wife and my kids. I was a good family man." Finally, the last man, he said, "I hope someone cries out, 'Look, he's moving.'" It's like the old saying, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to go right now. We'll all take a rain check. But not so with Paul. Remember the hardships that Paul endured? He was beaten with rods. He was pelted with rocks. His back ached, and his eyes were infected to the point where at times it was as if little daggers were penetrating his eyes, piercing his eyes. He called them his thorns in the flesh. The condition was incurable and recurrent. Paul had little attachment to this mortal body. In fact, he said to the Philippians in chapter 1, "For I am hard-pressed between the two, having a desire to depart and be with Christ, which is far better. Nevertheless, to remain in the flesh is more needful for you." Paul so longed for heaven that he had a tough time rationalizing why he should stay and remain on earth. Ultimately, it was to be of help to the church. God wasn't finished with Paul yet. But it's interesting. Paul had a longing for heaven. He was torn, and it was so strong that he was torn between the two destinations. In contrast to Paul, it's amazing what some folks today will do, what they'll put themselves through just to hang on to life for a few more days. You know, modern medicine has given us the means to extend our lives beyond the bounds of yesteryear. But brutal rounds of chemotherapy, excruciating treatments are often far worse than the disease. Now, I know it's easy for me to say. I've never received a terminal diagnosis. And I'm sympathetic to anyone who wants to hang on to life as long as possible, to savor a few more moments with their spouse, or to provide a child guidance, or even to meet a grandchild. This takes bravery. But the confidence to let go comes when we realize what's before us. God promises that we'll be clothed in glorious attire. Perfect health awaits us, a heavenly body. We'll inherit a habitation which is from heaven. There is a point, though, on which we're a little uncertain. 1 Corinthians 15 and 1 Thessalonians 4 both teach that believers won't get their resurrected bodies until the end of the age when the church is raptured. Yet here, Paul is clear that when we go to heaven, if we go before the rapture, we'll still have a body. We'll have a habitation. So what kind of body adorns the believers in heaven at this moment? Do they have a pre-released version of the transformed bodies that we'll be clothed in at the rapture? Do they have some kind of warm-up body, maybe a demo version? And quite frankly, I'm not sure. But what is certain is that when we get to heaven, we'll have a heavenly bod from God. We will. Heaven's like Snellville. Everybody is somebody when we get there. Here's the bigger question. Is heaven and all its glories something for which you groan and you long? Or are we so comfortable here on this earth, so fixated on the here and now, that we lack a taste for the glories of heaven? You know, the Bible refers to heaven as a feast. The Bible refers to heaven as a feast. You know what that means? No gluten-free in heaven. Hallelujah. No Jeannie Craig. No Weight Watchers. It's a feast. The delicacies and the joys of heaven are endless. But it's not just a feast. It's a wedding feast. So if you love food and you love Jesus, you should be thinking about heaven. You have as much of both as you'll like. Lawrence was a seminary student from Africa. When it came time for him to preach his first sermon, he chose a text describing the joys that we'll all know in heaven. His sermon started, "I've been in the United States for several months now. I've seen the great wealth that's here, the fine homes and cars and clothes. I've listened to many sermons in churches here too, but I've yet to hear one sermon about heaven. Because everyone has so much in this country, no one preaches about heaven. People here don't seem to need it. In my country, most people have very little, so we preach on heaven all the time. We know how much we need it." And I think his observation is true. You know, last week's sermon I've preached several times before. I talked about living for the spiritual, not the physical. The eternal, not the temporal. Living for the invisible, not what's visible. The sermon always blesses me when I teach it. But you know, I told Kathy when I got home last Sunday afternoon that it's funny how something that blesses me so, it always sort of receives a lukewarm reaction from people. It did last week. Some of you are quick to pat me on, oh, what a great sermon. Nobody mentioned a sermon last week. And you know, I wonder if we are guilty. If we are so comfortable in the here and now that heaven, the heaven that has been promised to us, seldom gets considered in our lives. I wonder. This might be why our faith is so shallow. How can we be heavenly minded if we have no longing for heaven? In contrast, Paul says, we groan earnestly desiring to be clothed with our habitation, which is from heaven. If indeed, having been clothed, we shall not be found naked. You know, the Greek philosophers saw the physical body as something evil. It was completely unredeemable. The body was a prison. It was a drag on the human spirit. Epictetus referred to himself as a poor soul burdened with a corpse. Seneca said that he was a slave of the body. The Greco-Roman hope for the afterlife was to be free from this body, to be a disembodied spirit. But Paul tells us God has a greater plan for us. He's going to transform these mortal bodies into eternal bodies. The very same body that we inhabit now will one day be resurrected. Our spirits won't be homeless. We'll simply move from a flimsy tent into a sturdy building. He says, for we who are in this tent groan, being burdened, not because we want to be unclothed, but further clothed, that mortality may be swallowed up by life. Understand, our redemption won't be complete until every trace of sin has been blotted out, including its effect on our bodies. You know, if you were in a car wreck and all the insurance paid for were repairs to the engine, you'd be disappointed, wouldn't you? What about some body work here? Well, God not only is a mechanic, He also has a body shop. He's not just an expert under the hood, purifying and sanctifying and energizing. He is an artist at redesigning wrecked frames and chassis. He is an expert at body work. Notice in this verse, the Christian's hope is not to be unclothed, but further clothed, better clothed. Some people think of heaven as this misty, ethereal, sort of an unearthly kind of place where the fog machine keeps everybody unrecognizable to each other. People and their mannerisms appear ghostly and ghastly, but that couldn't be further from the truth. In heaven, we're not unclothed, we are further clothed. Heaven is more substantive, not less. In heaven, you know, and you are known. You will know your loved ones. You'll grip them and hug them and embrace them. You'll know people that you have never met. Distinguishing features will be more identifiable, expressions more noticeable. Pats on the back and fist pumps and handshakes will be more palpable in heaven. Fellowship in heaven will be real and it will be hearty. If I can use the word, relationships are more earthy in heaven. We'll hug and it will matter. There'll be none of these little air hugs in heaven. You don't really want to touch them, but be none of that kind of stuff in heaven. You, when you hug somebody, man, it'll be a bear hug. Can you not wait to get a bear hug from Jesus? Won't that be cool?
Thanks for joining Pastor Sandy in this in-depth verse-by-verse study of the Apostle Paul's letters to the Corinthians. These two books dive into Paul's passion about how the church should conduct itself and the issues that followers of Christ will encounter. Paul's message is applicable today. You'll face challenges while you walk with Jesus too. Take the lessons the Corinthian church had to learn and make them your own. After all, history always has something to teach us. If you'd like to hear more messages from this in-depth study of 1 and 2 Corinthians, you can find them online at sandyadams.org. You can also take all of Pastor Sandy's teachings on the go when you download our mobile app. This is a great way to study God's Word as you go through life and could be an excellent opportunity to listen with friends and family. Find a link at sandyadams.org or search for Sandy Adams in your app store. Are you listening today in Atlanta? If so, you're invited to join us this weekend at Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain. Come listen to Pastor Sandy teach in person and meet some friendly and passionate people. We meet at 9:30 and 11:15 a.m. each Sunday. You can find all the information you need at sandyadams.org. That's all for today. Join us next time for another edition of Sandy Adams Radio.